You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 170 is Bob Mould. He started performing in Minneapolis in the early 80s with Husker Du, with co-frontman Grant Hart. After six albums with them, he went solo in the late 80s, released two albums, then formed Sugar. You're right now hearing their big single, If I Can't Change Your Mind, from Copper Blue, 1992. Broke that out after two albums and an EP in 1995. Has since put out 11 albums plus a couple dance projects. We're going to discuss Forecast of Rain from his last full album, Blue Hearts, 2020. Then I Don't Know You Anymore from 2014's Beauty and Ruin. Then look back to JC Auto by Sugar from the EP Beaster, 1993. And look way back to In a Free Land by Husker Du, a 1982 single remixed for their 2017 compilation Savage Young Du. And we'll conclude by listening to the Ocean World Cafe session from a brand new acoustic EP, The Ocean. Get more information at bobmould.com. Get more about this podcast at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And if you'd like to support the effort, go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. You can get my show notes with lyrics and structure breakdowns of all the songs. Finally, if you enjoy the show, please leave a nice rating or review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. I will have played a little of If I Can't Change Your Mind by Sugar from Copper Blue, 1992, to orient folks, although there are three distinct things I could have used to orient folks because, you know, of course, the Husker Du thing that you've talked about a lot. I see Something I Learned Today actually has, at least on Spotify, more downloads than If I Can't Change Your Mind, even though I'm sure it was not as big a hit at the time. And See a Little Light from your first solo album has almost that many. So I could have played any of those equally well. You well established yourself in at least three different distinct sounds before we even got going here.
That's great. I was going to say, I was going to add a couple that I think may surpass any of those, like the Daily Show theme.
Oh, of course. Yes. Yes.
Statistically, that hits more eardrums per day. But yeah, those are all good too.
Well, let's get quickly to the newest stuff, or the next to newest stuff, I'll say, because I know you sort of paused for the pandemic. And the most recent thing that we'll hear something from at the very end is sort of a live acoustic version. But your last full proper album, Blue Hearts 2020, Forecast of Rain, was the short tune that I picked that I assumed was one that you were leaning toward. It seems to have the most downloads. Do you want to give folks a brief intro of that before we hear it?
I think I wrote the music for that back maybe like 2018, 2019, when I was still splitting time between San Francisco and Berlin, Germany. And then the words, they appeared out of nowhere, as words often do. And, you know, sort of a quick look at the hypocrisy of certain religious folks, I guess mostly the American evangelicals, who in the 80s made my life tough, and from 2016 until now have certainly made all of our lives a little bit tougher. Just sort of using some real simple imagery in the words, you know, just asking, do all of these wonderful thoughts and prayers apply to everyone, or is it just to you and your folks, or the folks that you discriminate against or you try to suppress? You know, just throwing those ideas out there. As a former Catholic, I just thought I would ask those questions.
Those of the billions I joined in row lines. My sin. to orient folks about this Blue Hearts album, the general shape of the career. We've got those points that I mentioned at the beginning. And then, you know, I know a couple more after Sugar broke up. We have a couple more sort of rock albums to the point of The Last Dog and Pony Show in the 90s that was supposed to be the end of that because you were too old for that stuff. But now that was recanted after an album of dance music. We've now had a very steady, wonderful stream of albums. Where does this one exactly lie in the scope of the last five or so?
Blue Hearts is the fifth album made with Jason Narduzzi on bass and John Worster on drums. All five records have been on Merge Records in the U.S. It's been a heck of a decade with those five records. Blue Hearts specifically, it was sort of a deja vu all over again kind of feeling I was having. Mm-hmm. You know, I mentioned getting started with Husker Du in 1979 and being in a hardcore punk band and being somewhat political at the beginning and then moving more towards personal songs and being not closeted, but not an out gay young man. You know, the 80s were a mess. They were really tough. They were incredibly hard on a lot of my friends and a lot of people who did not survive the 80s. You know, we had a government, you know, the Reagan years were not good for me and my folks. And as 2016 turned into 2019, everything started feeling like 1982 again. That was the inspiration for Blue Hearts. It was a return back to protests, urging others to protest, touching on politics, touching on religion, touching on personal conflict. You know, I guess in my mind, I was making it sort of in the spirit of the records I made with Husker Du, where you're constantly writing, constantly reacting to the world, you know, as a young person with all kinds of conflict. I just went back and tried to look at those times quickly, not having to dwell on it too much, but just thinking about the limited tools I had at that time to make music. Mm-hmm. Looking at the environment, you know, living in a van, basically, or sleeping on people's floors and, you know, having the good fortune of making some work that resonated with people and still does. And that's the touchstone, I guess, for Blue Hearts.
Now, with this song in particular, what's your thought on sort of how you're combining the stance you're taking in the lyrics? All right. So it's sort of a prayer, but it's not like little piano. It's a prayer. It's a grandiose prayer, passive aggressive prayer that then goes into your normal, the I see your sheep, their strength, you know, this big fat guitar. Like there's actual sort of ecstasy there. How does those sorts of moods that in the verse and the chorus there combine with the message you're putting forth as far as you're concerned?
You know, it starts with a lot of questioning in the verses. And then when it gets to the first big chorus, it's, you know, more accusatory, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I try to settle it back down a little bit for the second verse, but it didn't settle down completely. And then again, the, you know, another big chorus. And then there's some beautiful, beautiful church organ to take us out to whatever the next song was on the album, which I think might be When You Left. But I think that motif that I just described is something that comes from the 80s, but also those dynamics. I played with those a lot with Workbook, the first solo album in 1989. I mean, it's just pretty much working the grooves I know, you know, and trying to stay reactive to what's happening.
Well, and speaking of the actual grooves, I mean, even the rhythm of the lyrics. So high upon your holy throne, like that, mm-hmm. You know, it's only because everything under it, you don't have a funky drum there. It's thundering rock, but then you can actually do this sort of R&B thing with your voice and have it add a little, you know, that it's not merely grandiose.
Oh, thanks. That's a great description. I would add, you know, semi-sneering on top of it.
Any thoughts about just how you weave together the wall of sound here? So having the 12-string acoustic in the background and cymbal heavy, and is the bass really just playing half notes there, not adding any rhythm? Is that what I'm hearing?
Jason's staying with John's kick pattern, and he is carrying a lot of the chord movement when it goes from the descending high upon your holy throne. You know, he's just walking down from a one through a major three, through a one, through a major three. It's got a McCartney feel to it, I suppose, when you throw the major three in. That's the function of the bass on that song. The architecture of it, you know, started with guitar. It started with guitar in a drop tuning. It got recorded with conventional tuning. So it was written on guitar, then all of the synthetic or keyboard elements got added later. I think the way that they build from the first verse and then the second verse, they have a similar feel, but there's a bigger density to it. A lot of that is, you know, that kind of arranging is, you know, when I think about that one, I think about all the time I spent DJing and listening to electronic music and how one builds the story throughout a song with electronic components.
Well, that's a really great synth sound. I thought it was strings when it started, but then it obviously has portamento somewhere in the middle, so that it's clearly a patch of some sort. Are you just one-handing that yourself?
On the previous record, Sunshine Rock, I had done a lot of string arrangements and used an orchestra from Prague to record the Prague, Czech Republic. So this time again, Down and Dirty didn't have time to get an orchestra together. So grab that old, you know, that Matrix 1000, sort of that PBS synth sounds that we remember from our childhood.
Okay. It seemed to me that it had progressed significantly since I remember in Beaster that you had a track which, you know, had this elaborate one-handed synth thing that like seemed sacrilegious at the time, almost, you know, just compared to the rest of the, but here it, you know, it melts very nicely into the mix.
Everything sits pretty well in that mix. There's a lot going on. And again, with trying to make a quicker record, typically if I was, you know, spending a lot of time mixing an album, I might spend a day pushing different parts around. But that one was pretty much get things that sound right and sort of stuff them all together and not sweat the technical part too much.
So am I reading the message right that you're starting off with this, you folks are so intolerant, and then ends with environmental catastrophism, as in you're going to be punished by your willful ignorance by global warming killing everybody, something like, is that the gist?
I was just probably having some kind of like, let's call the god of thunder on this one.
Uh-huh.
That was my assumption with the character, is like when the character becomes more accusatory, I had to double in size and scope, so.
Yes, that starts out as praying and then moves on to, I am the thunder.
That's right. Yeah, I'm the thunder, I'm the vapor. Yeah, all the natural elements that can't be stopped.
I'm the sun, you are the moon, play me. What is Neil Diamond lyric or something is coming to mind here?
Until they come up with other names for these celestial objects, that's all we got to work with.
There's probably a poetic name for putting the forces of nature in first person, that this has probably been done for hundreds of years. I don't know what exactly precedent to call in here, but it certainly works well with this divine calling here that the whole song has. Let's get a second song out there. Going back a little bit, I had chosen from Beauty and Ruin 2014, I Don't Know You Anymore. So this is sort of a classic Sugar-esque, also pretty short. This one at least hits almost 3 minutes, whereas the last one was 2.5. Do you have any words about where you were at this point and this song before we hear it?
Pop song. I think it sits number 3 on the album, so it was intentionally put there because I typically put what I think will be a single in the number 3 spot because that's what pop groups did in the 60s. It's a, you know, song that's got cute metaphors, you know, the whole tape rewinds and erases, you know, it's the idea of letting go of a relationship or letting go of the memory of something or someone, you know, just using fun, you know, like little studio allegory, the tape rewinds inside my head shedding and it can't be saved. It could be an answering machine too, you know, an old-fashioned answering machine way back when we had analog recording devices as our primary means of leaving messages. So, you know, I think structurally, we're looking for like an inside baseball thing. After the solo and the bridge and the quick drop, and then we have, I think, 3.5 choruses out. I guess in my mind, the way that I was trying to stack everything would be akin to Windy by The Association. That's a 60s pop song. If anybody goes back and listens to the long fade on that, they'll probably recognize the palette, the way things enter and exit. When I'm putting stuff together, one of my main touchstones is all of my 60s pop, you know, mostly my 45s that I still have. And when in doubt for an arrangement thing or when I look for inspiration, I'll just start playing some singles and all of a sudden a crazy sound will jump out of somebody else's work and I'll go, aha. I bet I could do something similar to that.
A thousand pieces of my heart, covered by surround. this has your classic fat guitar. How many guitars are you overdubbing to make the beginning of the song there? Is that really just one, or is it mixed in a clever way so that the bass notes of the guitar are spread wider than the treble? Or how are you actually recording that?
It's basically two parts. It's a rhythm part and a lead part. The lead part is the melody that you recognize. The other part is the capo two first position cowboy chords through a number of amplifiers that we would create a big wide stereo spread with those.
That's what I'm hearing, that the chimed notes at the top, this is even apart from obviously a little melody that's going on there in a second guitar, but you seem to have a trick where, you know, it almost sounds like there's a second bass, like the bass is actually holding down its part, but then your low strings are filling up that stereo space in a way that's distinctly different from the high chimey notes. And yeah, so putting that through multiple amps and processing it like that, that would make sense.
Yep, that's the trick. I think with those, it's probably, that might have been like an old Park head through a 412. It would have been a Blackstar Artisan 100 through a 412 cab, both close mic'd a couple different ways, and then like an 87, you know, Neumann U87 out in the room, and then just creating a stereo track with all of that.
And then how are you deciding sort of how prominent that little melody should be? Like, I was thinking it actually came in on the second or third measure, but it's right there at the beginning. It just takes a minute to focus on it because it's not mixed that high, just right at the beginning. It's not like you're cranking it like this is the lead part. It's like, it just blends nicely into the wash.
I would call that the signature. So that's what I call that kind of part. That's the signature riff that will come back at you a couple different times throughout the song. You know, I think in that song, I may have held the return of it until the triple chorus so that it's like a recollection piece at that point, setting a signature with that sound. And then I think the other guitar, the cowboy chord thing, has like a quick, snappy, like a 7-to-1 kind of thing on the last chord every two bars. Do-do-do. You know, which is like another sub-signature.
How much are you directing the drummer in terms of what to fill the space with? So I hear, you know, in 1,000 Pieces of My Heart, the steady thing is an open hi-hat, or at least, you know, partially open hi-hat, as opposed to let's open it wide and crash on every quarter or something like that. Is that just something you're feeling out with the live band as you're going to see what it needs?
Wide open hats and rides and crashes on choruses, tamp it down on verses so that you can get some legibility, but not too much legibility for the vocals. And that was recorded in 2013. And it seems now when I listen to music in 2022, everybody forgot to bring their cymbals to the recording session. It definitely sounds like it's from 2014 with all of that. You know, there's a lot of cymbal energy. You know, John, Jason, and then mm-hmm. I, the three of us have played together for many years now. And I think we all grew up generally in the same musical neighborhood. These are things we don't even have to talk about. I mean, John sort of knows, oh, it's the chorus works. This is the excitement. This is the heat. This is when I get to heat up the brass.
You know, I forgot to mention, I think in Forecast of Rain, I noticed as we're finishing up the verse, there's some eighth note percussion thing. I mean, it could just be him playing hi-hat or something, but it sounded like overdubbed percussion, like you had some second thoughts. Do you really just sort of leave it to a single drummer, or do you at least sometimes go in there like, you know, just like with the guitars, we need to layer on some more stuff?
Oh, percussion day is always a day. You know, that's up there with birthdays and anniversaries. Percussion day is, you know, never too far away from that tambourine. Never too far away from those shakers. And at Electrical Audio in Chicago, they have a hell of a percussion locker. And when it's percussion day, I just say, have at it, John.
Okay, I just didn't know if there was still some sort of purist streak left in you of like, this has got to sound as much as possible, just like a three-piece. And if I need to put on a second guitar just to thicken it up, that's fine. But otherwise, or a lead synth line or a strings or something. But it sounds like, no, you've done enough of these albums that anything like that has gone out the window long ago.
No, I build a brick wall and add lots of wonders. No problems with that.
Looking at the structure here, with the way you're structuring this, it sounds like you're taking pretty directly 60s influences, as opposed to the next song that we'll bring up from JC Auto. Sounds like it has about five distinct sections in here. This one is just a nice classical, very short bridge. Everything goes pretty much directly into everything else, except for the having a little space for the solo.
Yeah, it's what? Signature, verse, pre, chorus, verse, pre, chorus, bridge, solo, verse, solo, then a bridge, then a quick drop, then 3.5 outs. Yeah, that's the structure for that one. It couldn't be more 1966, could it?
So I guess in the bridge here, you add this, are you using an octave on the lead guitar? Something that is doubling the vocal line or at least enhancing it. Seems like that's one of your signature tricks, is have an extra fat treble guitar come in to make the vocal stronger.
Yeah, I use that trick a lot. A lot of that is octave moves on the guitar. Typically an octave built on the A and G strings, what I call the claw position. So,
well, that's going to sound better than a Weasley. I don't know, maybe octaverse pedals sound better now. But the one that I had always has just a weird fake synth sound to it when you add an upper or a lower.
I agree completely. The reason I tend to stay away from those now is they glitch as you're moving around. Sometimes they don't read the note quite right. And I mean, I'm a pretty good rhythm player and a pretty average, at best, lead player. So it would just start glitching out. My timing as a lead guitarist is nowhere near what it is as a rhythm guitarist. So I try to keep my lines simple.
Well, I guess at this point, you wouldn't actually do it with a pedal anyway. I know in songs that when I'm trying to create a wall of sound like this, I have sometimes like, well, let's take the guitar track and artificially generate an octave lower than it, and put that low in the mix just as something to be rumbly and take up space. Are you using that kind of trickery as well?
I know what you mean, and that's a good way to get that. I tend to just stick to doing it with octaves. I mean, if, you know, I could always grab like a baritone guitar if I wanted to get that kind of somewhere between the low guitar register and the low bass register. The Coronado, I think, is the Fender model that does that, almost like a guitar bass hybrid. I would use something like that. You know, always pull up a synth. And those tend to add the best kind of density because you're using a completely new source and you're avoiding a lot of the phase cancellation that you might get otherwise.
You know, if you're layering guitars and things, is there a lot of like sort of unnatural things that you have to do with the EQ just to keep them out of the way of each other? Your vocal pokes through very, very well. I was just listening to the Husker Du podcast that came out a few years ago, and you were saying how those major labels, they were pushing, like, can you make the vocals more present? But it seems like starting with Sugar, the vocals are more present. Like, you can pretty much hear every word on every song. So you seem to be okay with that.
Even with Workbook, vocals were up the most. Black Sheets, they went back down. Sugar, they came and went, depending on whether it was a pop song or a pile driver song. I tend to like to move the vocals back a little bit. Sometimes for me, when the vocals are really present, the band track suffers for it. And I don't mean like suffer like, oh, that's suffering, but it just sounds a little less powerful.
Sure.
Trying to dig space out for vocals. With the amount of guitar miking and amps and layering that I occasionally get into, you know, I have to be really mindful of phase. Having said that, sometimes when I put up a couple guitar tracks and they sound like a mess, all of a sudden, as you know, as a musician, you start getting all of those ghost notes and overtones and things that you can't even imagine. You know, I mean, somebody like Kevin Shields is a master with that. It's just the way that different harmonics interact. A lot of times I'm like, I don't care if it's in phase or out of phase. People are going to listen to it the way they listen to it. And this cacophony and all of these magical notes that I did not write that are now like front and center for me, that's the way I'd like to hear it for the rest of time. So I wish I could say there's like a specific roadmap for everything, but I think I'm conveying sort of how I work with this stuff.
What's your philosophy on reverb? It seems like you have enough miking and reverb on the individual guitars and things that like you don't necessarily need to add, say, reverb to the whole mix, or have certainly your vocal is not typically drenched, though that is at least one way that I've heard of, like, how do you get a voice to sit with a giant wall of guitar sound? Well, reverb the crap out of it.
I tend to lean more on temporal delays that have regeneration. I mean, I love reverb. Don't get me wrong. I mean, every studio should have an EMT, you know, a good plate reverb and a mechanical plate reverb. And I'll use a touch of it on voice, but not in the, you know, like a Roy Orbison way or like a surf guitar way. Or I'm not real big on super obvious reverb unless I'm trying to create a big distance between the narrator and the music. And as I said, I typically don't hang vocals that far out like that. So,
well, and what's your take on backing vocals? That you got nice 60s-ish, but not overdone I would be tempted on this chorus, you know, with the ahs, you know, to layer four harmonies on it or something and make it a little more Beach Boys. But you seem to have stuck to kind of the roughly the Husker, the rule book in terms of not fattening it up too much, not sweetening up crazily.
You know, it's with each cycle, there's an additional call and answer that gets added, as opposed to stacking harmonies directly on top of each other. Typically get a good lead vocal, get a couple different background vocal options, and then just keep adding more spice as the song tails out. That's pretty much my MO. Traditionally, I have done a lot of the backgrounds myself, but you know, having Jason Narduzzi, who's got such a wonderful voice that complements everything that we're doing, I now just step back and like, Jason, what do you hear? And you know, go throw some stuff around, you know, sort of like percussion day, but background vocal day.
I mean, is there a sense that the background vocals have to have, I don't know, I don't hear, like, knowing Jason's lead vocals, I don't necessarily hear those jumping out as, you know, in the way that Grant as a separate lead vocal personality in the band, like everything since then seems to have been more, the character of the lead vocal is, you can drench more in reverb and it's going to be sort of a paler version of the lead or something like that.
With Jason, sometimes they sit back a little bit, sometimes answer. I think it really depends on what the band is doing and how much space there is and how important, you know, having that additional character. Well, like a song that I would call up as like complete madness that works great is American Crisis off of Blue Hearts, where, you know, I wrote the words, I showed them to Jason, I said, are you down with these words? And he's like, fuck yeah. So I just went in and did 8 lead vocals and cut a couple main ones together out of that, you know, like most of take 5 and part of take 6. A little bit of 7 right there to correct, you know, that part where I scream too hard. And then, you know, I would look at Jason, just go, he'd be like, what do I do? Just go do what you do. And we'll just get a bunch of them and we'll either comp it together or we'll just, in the case of American Crisis, he and I just kept singing more and more and more. And then we just kept layering them on top of each other. So it had that big, big density, sort of like JC Otto from Beaster when you mentioned that earlier.
Let's get that out there, just to have another, a completely different band. And this is going to be over 6 minutes long. So we get to see the other end of your arranging spectrum. Yeah. So this is Beaster 1993, but these were just recorded at the same time as Copper Blue, right? As your main album that was just sort of delayed.
Yeah. We recorded 30 songs, I believe. I brought in 30 and we finished 10 for Copper Blue, 6 for Beaster. And there was a lot of really excellent B-sides as well. But yeah, that was like the yin and yang kind of thing. And Beaster came out so quick because Copper Blue was having such great success. I convinced Alan McGee. I said, come on, Alan, I'm doing the fucking Beatles every 6 months. Come on.
Well, yes, I remember being in maybe a Borders. This was long enough ago that that still existed and being very surprised at this coming out and paying the crazy Borders price for that. Can you say something about JC Otto in particular? So this is definitely the yang. This is definitely one of the darker ones, even on this album.
Yeah, JC Otto is shorthand for Jesus Christ autobiography. Get on the cross and yell kind of song. You know, the whole Beaster motif is inflicting a lot of stuff onto myself. You know, a lot of my own confusion, concerns, just, you know, amplifying them and turning them inward. And then when I do that, this is what sometimes it sounds like in my head.
But before we hear that song, let's do the ad break. First, I want to tell you about Masterclass, where you, a proven lover of audio, a curious person interested in the arts, get to learn from some of the world's best minds, people way too famous for me to have on this show, despite the majesty of Bob Mould. Though maybe they'll ask him to do one. I don't know. I'm talking musician-wise about Ringo Starr teaches drumming and creative collaboration, Carlos Santana on the art and soul of guitar, Herbie Hancock on jazz, Hans Zimmer on music scoring, Reba McEntire on country music, and there are new classes all the time. There's one by Mariah Carey on the voice as an instrument, something I'm sure she knows something about. I did not look at that one yet. This week, I looked at what looks like a even more interactive kind of class. There's one by Ninja on becoming a streamer. If you have wanted to stream yourself playing video games or doing anything else, this is a class that's explicitly designed with an outcome of you getting your own streaming brand going. So he will walk you right through how to get started streaming, how to make your setup, what software to use, how to get feedback, how to come up with a format and a routine for doing this. And you will get feedback from teaching assistants and peers. So more like an actual class. I mean, all the classes have interaction with listeners via comments. They all have extra materials, PDFs of music or recipes or whatnot that you can download, but this is taking it to a new level. So always something new and cool to find on Masterclass. I highly recommend you check it out. Get unlimited access to every Masterclass. And as a Nakedly Examined Music listener, you get 15% off an annual membership. Go to masterclass.com/NEM now. That's masterclass.com/NEM for 15% off Masterclass. I want to thank my very long-running sponsor, Nebbia. This is a creator of cutting-edge shower technology. I have one installed in my home. I'm actually liking it more as time goes on. This despite the fact, and this is my first time confessing this, that I have it configured in a place where my plumbing is kind of screwed up so that when water comes out of the shower, a lot of water still comes out of the bath faucet. So a lot of the water savings that this shower offers, I'm not actually experiencing. It's even with my old shower head, a lot of water was getting wasted. So until I get around to calling a plumber, this is not even the reason I'm still using this shower. I'm using it because I enjoy it. The Nebbia Quattro, the kind that they sent me most recently, has four spray modes, as I've often told you. There's the high pressure spray modes. There's the I want to wash the dog or the baby spray mode. The one that I prefer is still the classic spa shower mode, which uses atomized droplets to supercharge the air with, I forget the technical description, but it is a luxurious feel, a way you could upgrade your quality of life at a pretty low cost. Nebbia by Moen Quattro starts at just $119 exclusively on Nebbia.com. Nebbia gave us a special discount just for our community. Go to Nebbia.com/NEM and use code NEM at checkout to get 10% off all Nebbia products, which includes that Quattro high pressure water saving shower that starts at $119. It also includes their quick dry earth mat, their shower shelves, their shower curtains, Hooks bath mats, all constructed very sustainably and designed by former Tesla, NASA, and Apple engineers who are passionate about water savings and about apparently being in the shower. Again, go to Nebbia.com/NEM. That's Nebbia.com/NEM to check out what they have to offer and save 10% with the code NEM. All right, let's get back to the show. It is the song by Sugar, JC Otto. We'll be right back.
Yeah, any thought about this intro? This is a long time now. If you don't remember some of these details, that's fine. But
oh, no, I remember this one well, because this was 1983. The Sugar Records were recorded for Rykodisc. And I remember when they were getting ready to campaign Beaster and we were getting ready to tour, they wanted to pull JC Otto as a single. And somebody clipped the "and" kick off of the front. So when I heard like the promo CD, I was like, somebody left out the "and" kick, because it's "and bop 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 and bop 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 bop." And I was like, I don't think we can use these.
It is actually there on the Beaster version. It is restored. I see. And then when you have the bass and the lead come in, your lead is just sort of suspended in the air there. I would sort of expect there to be a fat rhythm guitar or something filling it out. But instead, it's just rah, 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 with the bass. So did you sort of dictate the bass riff on that? Do you remember? You're bending up, he's bending down.
The Sugar Records were tightly orchestrated before the three of us got together. The demos were very orchestrated and very true to the writing demos. So that move was in place.
So listening, there's a live version of this on the Copper Blue Extended, seeing which things David is actually singing backup for. You know, a lot of the backups are sort of, they come in later in the song live than they do here. And the fact that he actually takes the I know repeated thing, which seemed to me like the hook. So on the studio version, you're singing that, right?
I'm singing everything on that record. Mm. And a lot of times when we would take songs like JC Otto to the stage, it would just be a matter of who needs a breath, who's got breath.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense that you're playing pretty busily under there to not have to hold down all those I knows through that section. Structurally, what is going on here? There's a chorus, there's a bridge, there's a chorus. What, at least the way I charted it out, you got your verse, chorus, bridge, chorus two, the I look like Jesus Christ, then back to another verse. What do you consider the chorus here? What I was thinking, the bridge happens twice, so that can't be a bridge.
Where signature and title meet is the chorus.
Gotcha.
That's chorus.
Well, you got your, you know, I've done, da, 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 that's the obvious, the verse, but then it opens up that when everything seems wrong, I need to look for something, you know, that sounds like we're in the chorus here. And in fact, it ends with the holiday, which is sort of like, okay, here's a tag, but then that's half the musical material in the song. I guess this is one that deserves to be 6 minutes long. It's not merely that we're like going to have a 4 minute guitar solo and make it earn its keep that way. There's enough structural material that you needed this, even though it's not super slow.
The bridge that gets to holiday, yeah, that was, you know, just that's like verse, bridge, chorus. And then there's was there a bridge adaptation somewhere in there? I haven't played.
So when there's nothing left to all the color.
That you sprayed upon it. Yep, passing judgment on my life. You did. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, the inside baseball on this one is the parts of it seem over now. You expect a real solution. Mm-hmm. That spells out poison years, which is the same. That's the callback. That's the prize for that one.
You know, you mentioned on the previous song, like, I think I took part of the fifth take. You seem to have trained your voice so that you don't get hoarse. That when I was trying to sing like this in college, I would be hoarse at the end of every goddamn show.
It's all I can do to get to the next day at this point. I sing hard. I'm untrained. I've done a lot of damage to my voice. I do the best I can with what I have left. It's a constant struggle with shows. It just wear and tear. Too many years of smoking cigarettes early on.
I don't know. Do you get professional assistance in terms of my dedicated person who gives me lemon or whatever you need to do to make your voice actually functional?
I've gone through a handful of specialists and there'll be more to come, I'm sure. Yeah, I have a lot of different things I do. I try not to talk at all when I'm on tour. I barely sing maybe 30 seconds at sound check just so they can make sure the mic is going and they can get a touch of EQ and get me up in the monitors. And then I just let it rip for 90 to 110 minutes and then I shut up until the next sound check.
I think I saw this tour and you know, it seemed, even though it's of course hard to make out the vocals in the live setting, at least the way they were running the PAs back then in Austin or whenever I saw that anyway, but I recall like around the same time that I saw Crowded House live and how he on some of his stuff will do the same sort of like really rip it on the album, but somebody like must have whipped him or something so that live everything is very nice and well supported and trained. So like, this is what has to happen for your voice to actually survive past a certain age. At least that's what I thought. But your voice seems, you know, you sound just as good, I feel like, on the recent records as 5 records ago.
Yeah, thanks. No, I appreciate that. Live, but touring, the deeper I get into touring, the harder it gets. I'm getting older. If we think of the voice like we think of, the rubber bands that hold the newspaper together, if you didn't change those rubber bands for like 10 years, they will snap. And that's sort of how the voice is. Over time, you know, there's the shape of the muscles, everything changes. And for me, it's a lot of maintenance. Use a lot of herbal teas. You know, I think most people are familiar with this tea called Throat Coat, which I know a lot of educators use it because they're lecturing all day. It's like a slippery elm bark, I believe. And I started doing this thing. I had a friend in Berlin, a younger singer in like a real big hard rock band, and he would lose his voice occasionally. And he showed me this thing called Wax Vox. Do you know of this?
It sounds familiar.
It's a technique where you use reverse pressure on your voice. Like you'll get a 0.5-liter plastic water bottle and you fill it up maybe a third of the way. And then you insert a hose and you shape your vocal cords and your mouth a certain way and you push notes through the hose into the water. And what it does is it's like a reverse, you can sort of imagine it now, right? What it's doing to your vocal cords, it's applying reverse pressure to them. Make a fist and go into it just like that and feel your voice box when you do it. That's the thing that I do, and I will do that as much as I need to right before I go on to try to get the muscles warmed up and responding properly.
Well, damn, that's a real innovation. I'll look that up.
LAXVOX. There's lots of videos online that show the method and the technique and the materials you need to do it. It's pretty simple. It's just go get some fish tank hose from the hardware store and cut it to a certain length and get a bottle and fill it up with water and just start singing into it. It's sort of like Peter Frampton, but into a water bottle.
Now, normally I only do 3 discussion songs on these, but some of the ones we picked were very short. So I felt like since you had just gone through this relatively recently, Savage Young Do, remixing, remastering the entire very early catalog, I pulled out In a Free Land, the 1982 single. Are you okay going back to talk about this briefly?
Oh, hell yeah. All right.
I could have picked something, a really early songwriting attempt, but this seemed like the first one that had your full on, the guitar sound for which you became famous. Although there's some chorus in there, there's some little 80s-ness in there that I kind of wasn't expecting. I don't know, can you say a little of where you're at with this as a social commentary song, as the progress of that band in 1982 here?
We had songs that had pop sensibility, you know, early on. Even in the incredibly messy dim that is Lamb Speed record, there's a lot of nice melody in there as well. You are correct that this is sort of the beginning of, you know, leaning into the Eventide H910 harmonizer, which was a rack-mounted, sort of one of the early harmonizers from the late 70s. That was, you know, my first attempts at spreading the guitar a little bit wider in the mix, as opposed to sticking it on one side like the first Ramones album, which I love dearly and learned how to play by copying that record. The lyrical content could not be more timely today. And it's as timely as it was 40 years ago. You know, it's a really nice protest song. I think the sentiment is pure and good. And the riffs are, you know, those are riffs that I have recycled many times. And sometimes when I listen to other musicians, I hear those riffs in their songs as well, and I think that's a wonderful thing.
Don't mean a thing. Don't mean a thing. Don't mean a thing.
Any thoughts about the interaction of the band to get this arrangement? Was this just completely like all worked out in rehearsal? No, at least at this stage, no sort of play fewer notes, play. Any thought about that?
We learned the music before we knew the vocals. We didn't really rehearse a lot with a PA. It would just be the three of us in a room learning the music. And then we sort of, the vocals would reveal themselves like right before recording or during recording. A lot of times didn't really know what songs were, you know, I mean, we sort of had names for them, but I didn't know what Grant's words were about and he didn't know what mine were about. In a Freelander, that was probably like 4 hours at Blackberry Way, which was a studio in Minneapolis. I would imagine there was some alcohol involved. I would imagine everything was first take. We probably spent 2 hours setting up, 10 minutes recording, and a half hour tearing down. Not much thought behind that.
And it's the same verse used twice, which I'll just, government authorized education. They'll teach you what they think.
Want you to think.
Saturation of stars and stripes. And then at least in the version that I have written down is the only freedom worth fighting for is for what you think, which I would never have guessed. It seems like there are not that many syllables in what you're singing either time, but you're saying that's accurate.
That is accurate.
Okay.
And I still try to sing all of those syllables like this year when I play the song. I forget what I have a shorthand of it that I do some nights. Freedom to fight for what you think. Freedom worth fighting for what you think. Those are the main words. You can cut it down to that if you're out of breath.
Does it make it more sloganistic by just having the one verse that we're going to repeat twice? And, you know, that's the more the punk ethos rather than, well, let's use the second verse to develop it or something.
It's just quick and dirty. I didn't even give it that much thought.
Why bother spending time reading up on things and writing the second verse?
Second verse, same as the first.
You know, it sounds like the government is brainwashing you, but then everybody's an authority in a free land. That this sounds more like ripping on the anti-intellectual. It's a different target than the verse.
Don't know what the target was then, but sure sounds like a tweet to me.
Yes. Everyone's an authority. That's our freedom.
Yes, we're free. It's every night is open mic night. Yeah.
How did you see your stance as punk social commentators as compared to what you were hearing in your peers, some of which were, I'm guessing, more straightforwardly fight the power? This at least has this kind of backhanded, more nihilistic, everybody sucks. Yes, the government is trying to, but I hate anti-intellectualism too. Something like, just think for yourself.
It's a wholesome Midwest approach to nihilism. A lot of the bands that we were colleagues, I guess, with at the time, like the Kennedys or MDC or Black Flag or the Dicks, people like that, their politics were fully embedded in almost everything they did. Whereas I think with Freeland, it was just that seemed like a quick missile to sort of throw into the universe, you know, a good excuse to burn a flag to get the cover art. And that's sort of where it started and ended. But the beauty of it is, again, this seems like 40 years later, it still resonates with me. Whenever I call that one up, I always have a good time with it.
Well, I don't know why the particular sound of that fat guitar with chorus on it should resonate with freedom, freedom, but somehow it does. That it sounds vaguely patriotic in a badass way. This hasn't been appropriated like Born in the USA by any groups you don't like, I assume. It's not famous enough for that.
No big pharma, no nothing.
Well, I'll send it to Ted Cruz, see if he'll start using it. Just to.
I prefer you don't do that. Thank you very much. You're going to use that as his exit music on the way to Mexico for vacation? His song right now is Convoy, right? C.W. McCall?
Oh, gosh.
Now I'm in a mood. We should wrap it up before I say something really unsightly.
Well, let's instead say a few nice things about The Ocean, this EP that you put out. The two times I've seen you live are with Sugar and then in a solo acoustic tour. It was actually the one, the 2002 one, so you were using the synth backing on some stuff, but not on others.
Yeah, the films and tracks. That was so much fun.
Yes. But this seems like it's been a long time part of your live routine to at least do some just you and a 12-string thing, right? That goes pretty far back.
Well, let me see. When was the first solo acoustic shows? It would have been in 1989 as part of the workbook campaign. I think the first shows I did like that were at McCabe's Guitar Shop in Santa Monica, California. I enjoyed doing those. And then after I left Virgin Records in 91, I did a pretty much an entire year of solo acoustic and electric touring. So it's a format that I go back to, for instance, this year, where John and Jason are, you know, working on Superchunk touring, and John is working on Mountain Goats touring, and I'd like to keep touring so I can tour solo, which is a good way to keep campaigning the record and just feel like a productive person.
Well, and actually make a profit. I recall reading you saying that several times, that that was the main reason that you fired the first Husker band, is their hotel rooms were too nice, that you're not making profit on the tours.
No fault of theirs. I would lay that squarely on my inability to manage my management company. But the solo tours are really fun. They're simple. They're very inspirational. They're more intimate, so I get better feedback from people. You know, those 6 hours in the car each day, 5 hours, 4 hours, whatever it is from place to place, is really productive thinking time for me, because I'm, you know, sort of thinking about what people thought the night before, the songs that mean things to them. The solo stuff is really good for getting me thinking about what's next. It might seem counterintuitive because I'm going way back in the catalog and I'm playing new stuff. You know, just getting validation or reactions from people really is helpful at this point in my life. What is the work saying to people? What does it all mean once it leaves my head and hands?
Well, so just then a business question, it was, why a 3-song EP if clearly you're doing whole solo shows? I'm sure this could have been a 10 song or what, you know, or a complete career retrospective visit or something. But instead we have, you know, 2 songs that were on the last album, and then Divide and Conquer, a classic Husker song done much slower than anybody's ever heard it.
These were recorded originally for World Cafe, and the idea with highlighting these 3 songs now was just sort of a thanks to the fans. It wasn't meant to be a buy this, you know, it's a digital only release of some stuff that I think went under everybody's radar. A way to remind people that a tour is coming up, and, you know, thanks for your support. Here's 3 songs that you can add to your playlist for whatever streaming service, and off we go. You know, as far as like retrospectives, I mean, the Distortion box set really covered a lot of bases with that. I mean, you know, 24 CD box set and 4 different vinyl box editions, you know, of different eras. I mean, that's pretty some deep nostalgia there. But as far as like, you know, recording like a whole, you know, album's worth of acoustic stuff, maybe someday, but that wasn't the intention here. It was just sort of you know, 3 freebies and thank you. And here's a cool version of The Ocean that I recorded at home. So,
and that's a wonderful introduction to The Ocean that you recorded at home. So here it is. Thanks so much for doing this, Bob. It's not too many of my guests I can say, were we on video, I would show you my giant stack of products. Very cool. Thanks so much.
Last time from the sky to the ocean, carousel with billions of lights and sounds. You said I might not be there to prevent this in the future. Don't care, you don't need to witness inevitable events. My skin is like dirt, I keep scratching at nothing. Can't make it hurt enough. Losing all feeling, senses are failing me now. Building momentum, crashed out, the currents are taking me further out to sea. Right now, the weight of the world You're better without me. Sorry you had to witness this inevitable event.
Thanks so much to Bob. Definitely a bucket list interview for me. And he was very gracious about my fawning fandom. So I think we both got out of it unscathed. You can find out more about him at bobmould.com. Mould being M-O-U-L-D. I pronounced it Bob Mould. Well, until preparing for this interview, my entire being a fan of him, which makes me also think about Rick Ocasek, whose name is actually Ocasek, but he doesn't care how you pronounce it. But now he's dead, so you really should pronounce it right. My next interview, already recorded, is with Ben Vaughn, a very good songwriter with a sort of retro 60s thing. He's a one-man band. He's done lots of TV soundtracks. And like Bob, a very good conversationalist. So come back for that. Make sure you're subscribed directly to the Nakedly Examined Music feed. You can find the many links to do that at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And of course, if you want to avoid my ad reads and get my notes on the episode and my eternal gratitude, I would love your per episode support. Could be for a very small amount at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. Folks, they're only charged when I actually release an episode. You sometimes get the episodes early. There's occasionally bonus material. It's like a party in your computer where I promise not to talk about showering at all. I hope you're doing well musically and otherwise. I have had some activity. I released a couple of my 90s albums on Bandcamp. That's marklint.bandcamp.com. If you want to hear me in my heyday when I was still maybe trying to go pro. But that was long ago and podcasts keep me pretty busy now. However, I did drag my electric guitar and amp upstairs for the first time in a long time. I was jamming on that for quite a while in addition to my regular drumming routine. All this will hopefully move me toward wanting to actually write and record a new song. I have some fragments of things, but nothing that I'm super happy with. So that's where things are with me. I hope that you can keep on musicking. Until next time, Mark Linsenmeyer signing off.